Great. So, a few reminders just before we kind of dive in. The due date for written comments on the property offenses is November 3rd, a month away. The next meeting is scheduled for November 1st, Wednesday, November 1st at this time. This is 3 to 5 o'clock on Wednesday, November 1st. And then again on Wednesday, December 6th. I want to confirm that's 3 to 5 o'clock also on December 6th. Something I sent, one email I sent around might have, it was unclear. Anyway, might have had 2 to 4 the old time, but our intent, and I believe, was to have Wednesday, December 6th from 3 to 5 p.m. So then in January, we'll switch up to the kind of morning schedule, 10 a.m. Just wanted to kind of tell everybody again that, you know, we're happy to meet with people individually, especially as you kind of like get more into a crunch here in terms of, you know, property offenses, you know, the latter part of October. But also that, you know, this is a draft. There will be another draft on property offenses at least. So, you know, right. If you want to put it in writing, we can also kind of respond and take it forward that way. Otherwise, I didn't have any other notes. We talked before about kind of focusing sequentially on these reports. We pretty much talked through, well, at least a number of issues with the definitions, aggregation, report 8. I don't know how far folks are in their review, but yeah, maybe just kind of open it up first with report 9 on theft offenses and kind of see if there's anything to start with. Opening it up. Yes, Laura.
Oh, I have a couple of questions. So a couple of, I think, relatively simple things and a thing that, at least for my brain, is tricky. And then I have a substantive thing that I'm hoping to hear thoughts of others. And everything else I'm saving for writing. Okay, so my first thing that I don't understand, chapter 9 or report number 9, I have it down as page 81, it had to do with, let me see, you said, oh, this had to do with, this is criminal damage to property, and making the point that the current MDP statute makes the gradation line, the felony misdemeanor line, on the value of the property. And you're making the point, overall policy point that I think is great, about the valuing the damage. And you say, when the item is only partially damaged, the revised CDP statute provides greater flexibility as to how the amount of damage may be proven, may either provide proof of the reasonable cost of the repairs, as recognized in prior DCCA case law, or it may provide proof of the change in the fair market value of the damaged property. And then the citation is about some rare cases, something. And I just didn't understand where I should be looking for that. Was that somehow in the statute in some magic words I missed, or a subsection I missed, or is that related to the way something's defined? I didn't object to the point, I just didn't get where I was supposed to know that as a practitioner in the future.
I believe, and Rachel will probably correct me, that it's in the definition of value. And you have the intersection of with the definition of value, which I've got the definition of value up on the screen. So the big macro level point on value, the definition, definition 24, it was discussed in commentary in report 8, but it's also in the compilation if that's an easier place for you to look. Value means, you know, A, fair market value of the property at the time and place of defense, or if the fair market value cannot be ascertained, then we get into this alternative land.
Well, let me go slow for 1 second. So
yep.
We're clearly not talking about the fair market value.
Right.
So we're talking about, and the amount of damage, is $2,500 more than $25,000, whatever. So
right. So the
that, so we must
cost
be
of
at least
replacement. Well, and, yeah. If the fair market value cannot be ascertained, we're for property other than a written instrument, which would be most everything, the cost of the replacement of the property within a reasonable period of time. So damage we talk about in terms of value, right? That is the loss of value.
We say the amount of damage is...
The amount of damage, and specifically it shows to not do value there for, just intuitively, it was weird to think about.
You might just ignore what I just said, because
okay.
This is actually like a last-minute change.
It was kind of a last-minute. We wanted to do value of damage, but if you stop to think about how the definition is written of value, and just intuitively, if I damage your computer, it's hard to imagine the fair market value of a loss,
right,
of the amount of damage. And so I think this is actually a point that we're making in commentary and not so much in the statute itself, because the statute itself is amount of damage, which is the standard in, I believe, most reform jurisdictions, if not all jurisdictions, and that's what the DCCA case law is getting at. But to say, you know, how can we red alert a practitioner that this is in there, is something we might want to think about, because it is kind of tucked away in commentary.
So, forgive me. This is the sort of thing that Dave would have been all over, so everybody else may know this. But this report, certainly it's for our understanding as we work on this, each report, like report number
right.
9.
Yep.
And it is kind of a draft of what ultimately might be what gets given to the council.
Yes.
So it's at least legislative history. What do we think is about to show up in the code?
So
a particular, just the explanatory note, national trends?
No, that is totally open to the council. Like, that would be, for any of this to be in, to be codified, would be unusual, right?
Okay.
Our proposal was simply to, you know, provide the statutory language and then an accompanying commentary, these kind of two pieces. Here you go.
And what's in the commentary?
This is commentary that you see here is the commentary. These are the documents that we would put forward to the council with our recommendations.
So in the end, it's all like legislative history.
That is right, although I will say, you know, there are degrees of legislative history, right? There's the, like, you know, this is the source. A number of jurisdictions, Hawaii is a notable one. Like, they, you get the comment, the official commentary on their code through looking at on Lexis. It is an official document that was not just kind of left behind at the stage of legislative history and legislative intent, but was kind of deliberately promulgated alongside as a, you know, a guide. Now, what is the status of that, right? Like, I don't know. We haven't kind of researched in these jurisdictions precisely how the courts in those jurisdictions have treated that kind of thing, where the legislature not only has, for instance, adopted, you know, what that bill, but said that this is the official commentary for it. Does that give it some greater standing than other legislative history from a committee hearing or something? I don't know. We haven't looked into that, and I don't think we're not planning to propose that.
Can I just say,
you know, how the council chooses to act at that point?
I sort of have a problem with that.
Yep,
it's been my ongoing thing.
Yep.
If we're not going to propose that a commentary be adopted,
yep,
then I need everything in the code.
Yep.
And it does not... I don't sleep easily knowing, oh, well, we just explain that in a commentary,
yep,
and then it's who knows what happens,
yep,
to that.
Yep.
I'm not as concerned as the, you know, what other jurisdictions are doing and all,
sure,
of that, but to the extent that it is the commentary and it is supposed to explain it, and we are therefore not,
sure,
proposing language in the alternative code itself,
sure,
I think we have to give them the commentary and propose it have some sort of legislative history adoption.
Except sure. the national trends.
Well, yes, except
well,
that's
fascinating.
That's exactly
and
right.
well worth doing.
Well, yes, and the rest, however they want to deal with that, that's a different animal to me. It's almost like the stuff that follows the criminal rules, you know, when D.C. issues it. It's not the official stuff, but it's... It explains
sure,
it.
Exactly.
And it's published with it.
And you know, whether it's published with it or not, the...
It's yeah, adopted
yeah,
with it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think, again, this really goes to, like, what, you know, how the council wants to handle this. I mean, look, we can't...
We
can make a decision at some point. We can advise
to
on it
propose you, that
about
it be
whether you
yeah, that's right.
make a recommendation on, about how they do it.
Sure. I will say this, right? Like, if it is adopted, which I agree would be helpful. I think everybody would agree it would be helpful. That's why we're kind of spending time, you know, kind of working on it too. It requires a. It will require reworking. After whatever changes happen at the committee level, right? In other words, you don't want it to be dated, right? So, like, you know, we'll be in business a while if we're going to have to keep massaging and updating the commentary to be always in step with whatever the final version of the text is, right? It's all well and good for it to come out from us at the same time, which we'll do, and we can put that with a proposal to adopt this commentary as legislative history. But it's another thing that then, once the text goes to the council, presumably, they hold a hearing, they make modifications, the commentary that
right.
then will, at least, needs to be updated. So I'm in favor of that. I think it'd be a useful tool going forward for training, for practice, right? Like, on all these levels, it would be very useful. One step would be recognizing as legislative history. Frankly, even if the council didn't recognize it as legislative history, if it, you know, whoever's moving the bill, whether it, you know, be the judiciary chairman or whoever it is, you know, is relying on that and citing it, it would then be, even if it weren't actually somehow said that it was legislative history, right, it would be looked upon as such, I believe, by the courts. Now, but there are different degrees of that. And if you want some special further status beyond just we're making very clear that this is legislative history, that we'd have to look into some more. What is that status? I'm not aware of a comparable thing elsewhere, right? You know, there are sections of the code larger that are, for instance, adopted from the Uniform Law Commission, right? Which has, in fact, issued like kind of commentaries and statements corresponding to the language it's pitching in the Uniform Law Act. Now, what is the status of that? Right, like maybe that's something that would be comparable, right? I don't know that the council's ever gone out of its way to say, you know, that commentary by the Uniform Law Commission has some kind of a special binding nature or, you know, some elevated nature. I think there might just be a general reference to it, and it is generally considered part of the legislative history that it was considered by the council. So
but it could be. I mean, it wouldn't
yeah,
necessarily
it could
have
be
to be super hard. I mean, one
yeah,
suggestion,
yeah.
just in case someone on the phone is
yeah.
taking notes, is sort of adopting all these reports as appendices or something to the committee report, and then the committee report just has to be
sure
we changed it. We
yeah.
you know, here's where we changed, here's an explanation of change,
that's
as opposed
right.
to having to re-explain
that's right.
everything else.
That's
you've saved
right.
a ton of writing
that's
and
right.
it's just to the extent originally written committee report is anything,
that's right.
it is yeah, we rejected their idea for blah blah blah, here's
yep.
the explanation of that. And then there's always some change that happens later, and then they're just
yep.
Who the hell knows?
Yep.
That's how it works.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense to me, except is it these reports that are the commentary, or is it the equivalent of these reports on whatever the final thing the commission does.
That's what I meant. This is filed as first draft of report number nine.
It'll be whatever the final report number comparison is.
In the end, we're hoping to just be one final report containing commentary, one final report with statutory language, and some sort of transmittal thing that we, you know, send along with the kind of gloss, here's what we've been doing, here's how it was assembled, etc. Statistics would also be part of that. That's part of what we need to submit to the council. But otherwise, those are the pieces. Now, I heard you saying, you know, you wouldn't need the need or want necessarily the national legal trends. That's definitely a consideration for how we just organizationally put together this final report, which is to say, right, we could sever that, we could sever statistics.
Or maybe the way we just talked about it for how the council could use it, it sort of doesn't matter.
That's right. If it's just like the giant appendices, then maybe it doesn't matter. But, you know, we can work with Chanel and, you know, about how...
Well, it does sort of inform what your thinking is, and if somebody has to read it later to say, I think that's...
I mean, as a baseline, though, I would say, like, right, I think our intent is that, you know, this, the final version of these, this commentary will end up being submitted to the council. It will be legislative history, unless it is explicitly distanced, as it were, from the final legislation by, you know, the committee or the council. Even if they don't say it as much, and then there are more ways that they could kind of proactively make clear that this is, and I think that would be favorable, and we should recommend that.
Okay,
that.
So that's really helpful, bringing it back to me.
Good.
Going back to the point about how you calculate value is a bad word to use, how you calculate. Determine the amount of damage or how it can be proved, whether that ends up being a section. Like, if that's buried...
For some jurisdictions, you will see, like, they'll still maybe use the term value for their damage to property statutes, but at least a few jurisdictions will codify a separate method for their damage to property as opposed to, like, value for the theft-type things. We can certainly consider doing that.
Whether it goes in definitions or just
this kind of, right. You know, for the purposes of this section, the amount of damage is determined as boom and make it part of the statute. And I think the reason we didn't do that is we were, again, the changing from value to a different phrase was towards the end of this draft. And also, is it too confusing to have one definition for this and one definition for theft? But since they are distinctly different things in their own way, I think that perhaps codifying it would be something. Worth viewing, because like you're right, how would you know as a practitioner? And you do see that in some jurisdictions.
And it's going to be hugely important. So I read it and thought, oh wait, what did I miss? So that was a particular thing that stood out.
Is the CDP statute something about the determination of the amount of damage? Because as I recall, using value is just problematic, because value, fair market value under current DCCA case law for MDP is only if it's totally destroyed. So if it's not totally destroyed, you're talking about value of something like fair market value of destruction or damage. When it's not totally destroyed, it just doesn't work. But we could certainly put something in the statute that is specific to damage calculation for this offense if that would be helpful.
The alternative is where we had until the last minute was, you know, we use value. And it was loss of value, okay, instead of damage,
right.
It was loss of value. But then it just felt in the end it got too complicated.
That wasn't it. I was just trying to read where you got that from. Yeah. Where a person reading this was to get it from, not where did you think of the idea from, but where I was supposed to have understood that's what you meant. That's what I meant. So I only have one other. I thought I had two points. So what I have left is the... My brain doesn't bend in the ways that it needs to understand this, and then I have my substantive thing. So, and that is how effective consent fits with consent so this specifically had to do with this unlawful use of property being clearly, it said somewhere in here, something about a how it was clearly a lesser included offense of revised theft, fraud, and extortion statutes. And when I just did the sort of matchup of elements for unauthorized use of property and theft, it matched up exactly, except for intent to deprive, and unauthorized use requires effective consent and theft required consent. And I either don't understand the test, highly possible, or I just don't get how it seemed like effective consent would have to fit under consent for it to be an LIO, and I couldn't get my head to understand. I just couldn't.
Good.
So I need some to talk.
I will turn to Bryson for this one. Who, you know, and again, I would maybe preface it with saying, like, yeah, this is something again, which, like, even towards the end, we were kind of making some decisions whether to go with effective consent or to unpack it, like we talked about the last.
Or to have a sentence that says it's
or not.
Well,
for the slow.
Yeah.
But okay. I don't know. But
yeah, anyway. Yeah.
So let's try and see if I can understand the concept.
So my understanding of the lesser included test is that the question is, for the supposedly greater included offense, have you necessarily proved the element of the supposedly lesser included, right? So if you prove fraud, have you proved UUP necessarily? And the answer is yes. And the reason that it is yes is that effective consent is really three things, or the phrase without effective consent can be satisfied by three conditions. It can be satisfied when the victim provides no consent, right? It can be satisfied when the victim gives consent, but the consent was obtained by deception. That's fraud, right? And then it can also be satisfied if the victim gives consent, but it's obtained by coercion. And that's extortion, what we're calling extortion. So for theft, for the theft and UUP relationship, like the normal theft by taking, right? It's taking exercising control over whatever, et cetera, property of another, without consent, with intent to deprive. So the first, or is there a fourth element in there that I'm missing? I don't remember. Anyway, so those elements, those first four, constitute one of the forms of UUP, that is, taking without consent. It just doesn't have the with intent to deprive. And then that's also true for fraud, except it's with consent obtained by deception. It's the first four elements, just not without
right.
intent to deprive, and then same for extortion, which is coercion, consent by coercion.
I got all that.
Yeah, yeah.
I like one, element one, match,
yeah,
check.
Yeah.
Element two, match, check. Element four didn't exist. I get how that's
right.
Is a lesser.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
The problem is three and three. So, which is consent and effective consent.
Right.
So I need you to go more slowly.
Yeah, yeah.
So if what the government... effective consent is consent obtained by means other than coercion or deception.
Mm-hmm.
So...
we need a Venn diagram.
Yeah. You do. That's what I said. Pictures.
So we've got a marker. We just don't have an eraser.
Yeah. So yeah, no... but yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yes.
That's it.
Correct.
I just, like, I can't even form the question because I'm so lost.
No, yeah, it's a little bit confusing. So what?
So we have to do unlawful use, right? And then be able to go up to, because unlawful use has to be totally within theft.
So the
right?
test has articulated it in the latest, the case that I drew the rule for LIOs. We have the first one from 1991, whose name I forget. That was like the where they settled on Blockburger. And the other one we have is Alfaro, which dealt with child cruelty, second degree, and simple assault, right? And I think what happened there is the DCCA said that simple assault is not a lesser included of second degree child cruelty, because second degree child cruelty contains this maltreats element, which can provide liability based on things other than bodily injury.
That's me.
Right. Oh, that's okay.
I was like, what's that noise?
But I think the best way to conceptualize the lesser included test is whether you satisfy the elements of one without the other. Once you have taking without consent, you've satisfied both theft and UUP. UUP doesn't require proof that there was fraud or require proof that there was coercion. those are alternative elements. So it's one of those three. It's their ors, not ands. So you've satisfied the elements of UUP once you've committed theft, even though there are those alternative elements out there for fraud and extortion.
Right. Yeah. I don't have any more fraud or extortion. So just UUP. Just so I'm sorry. I know everybody else maybe already followed this. I'm sorry.
No, it's actually
so,
not.
So, simple. Okay. So.
Yeah. Or put differently, Laura, I mean, I think one way, but for theft, because you have to lack consent of the owner, period.
Yeah.
Every time you lack consent of the owner, you also lack effective consent.
Yeah, sorry, I don't know if I made that
yes.
clear.
Yes, okay,
yeah,
so wait, yeah. I just have to say that slowly. So every time you lack consent, it means I didn't even get it by deception or coercion.
Exactly, yeah.
Right, exactly. You took it when the person wasn't looking or something.
Exactly.
You had no consent, period. Every time you lack that kind of basic consent, you also necessarily lack effective consent.
Yes. Okay. We can make it clearer if you want in the definition of effective consent. Or it could even, because this
well, if everyone else is like, yeah, Laura, we got it 10 minutes ago, then apparently it doesn't need to be clearer.
Well, no, I don't think so. The bigger question is
whether it impacts us at all. Like whether this conceptual, it trips us up, too. And so, like, whether it's again, just like, it's actually being helpful or it's not.
Right.
If we can unpack it, you know, so... Exactly. We could rewrite it, you know, instead of without effective consent, we could say without consent or without consent obtained by that's trouble.
Yeah.
Coercion.
Yeah. I think, yeah, it is, it's not great. And because it structures the relationship for these three common offenses, it might be worthwhile in UUP to pull them out. But if it's...
But that's one of the few places we use it, too.
You use effective consent a lot, although it doesn't need...
Yeah.
You know, it's just those came right after.
Yeah.
My guess is once people start using it,
yeah,
then they'll just... They won't necessarily understand it, but they'll accept that it's true. It's that I was trying to...
Yeah.
It was like a nice little surprise, and then I was like, wait, let me figure out how those really fit, and I couldn't get my brain to work that way. But... You know, it's either going to be a training thing, hey, folks, trust us, it really works this way, or there's a sentence somewhere, which maybe then goes back to what, or whatever. I just couldn't even figure it out, and I wanted to make sure it was true.
Well, it's an important relationship, and it's worth making clear in the easiest and best way possible, I think.
So,
can you just say, like, what? And I don't know what the word would be, right? Effective consent means consent, blah, blah, blah. This is in the definition. Effective consent is narrower. It is a less something that is like, oh, I see, it fits underneath. Literally, not like, I needed something that when I was reading it, I was like, that's a lesser, right? Literally, when I was matching them up, I needed to know this element is a lesser of this in the same way that these others crossed each other out. And that I just... When I hit it, I thought, wait, I don't... I assumed it when I first read the definitions, but when I saw it in practice, I thought, really?
It does
what?
Get mucky.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, like, the key places where it comes up, right, it's going to be... It is the relationship of UUP to theft, to extortion, to fraud. Like, those are the key ones. And so unpacking it there, maybe it is better. I last meeting, Renata kind of voiced that a bit. That she would like to see it kind of broken out this way instead, so that then when you line this up, you can see, well, if it's without consent, that is, you know, one of the options here. That's lovely. I pointed the arrow in the wrong direction.
Oh,
that's
maybe.
Awesome. That is one of the options here, and again, Bryson, kind of the ors are very important, right? Like, if you don't, like, to unbundle it that way might be helpful to kind of see that relationship.
Or is it fixing consent? I kept wanting to fix effective. Consent doesn't say anything about... You say it in the explanation, and maybe that's going to be... Right, you say consent by deception or coercion...
But not without consent? Is that, was that absent?
You say it in the explanation. Like, I knew...
Yeah.
Where do you say it?
Maybe that's...
It is somewhere in here.
Yeah, you know,
but maybe it could be in the... In the definition.
right?
We could restructure it so that consent is... I mean, we tried to make that simple and... I don't know.
Wait, you do... and now I can't even find it. Don't you say something in here?
There were a few lines in commentary that talk about, like, for UUP, lack of effective consent means there was no agreement. There was an agreement obtained by coercion, or there was an agreement obtained by deception. I don't know if that's what you're...
Or maybe it was in theft. There was some place where you explained it and said, even if you get it that way, was it not in the definition it was in theft?
That was... There's a sentence in the commentary for theft, and there's a sentence in the commentary for UUP.
So, what about being more explicit in consent, that it includes consent
obtained by
conception or coercion?
Mm-hmm.
So that it's clear.
Ineffective consent, you mean?
No, in consent. Right, you say it's...
Consent may... What you would say is consent may be obtained as defined here. May be obtained by coercion or deception. Because, again, I think people's intuitive notions, they're kind of conflicted on this, right? Like, it's just muddy, right? Is... You talk about consent, but what we often mean is true consent, which is not obtained by coercion or deception, right? You know, and we kind of muddy those around, and so, like, to pick one out, I hear what you're saying. Even in the statutory definition, say... For consent to say it includes agreement obtained by coercion or deception, that would be heavy-handed, but maybe that would be clearer. I don't. You know.
Yeah,
well, I need the heavy. I mean,
interests, then they match up.
Right.
Okay. And then if we did that, would you not want it? It would not be necessary to break it out. We could keep effective consent in there and not break it out. Would that
let's
clear?
Try.
Okay.
That's just.
Good.
That's okay.
No.
At least now I get the concept. Whatever you just mentioned.
Yeah, no, and we struggled with this too. And honestly, like, several jurisdictions have tried this. Texas
and Tennessee are the two that use effective consent in their property definitions for burglary, trespass, and some states kind of do this in a way without consent with respect to their theft offenses, depending on how they define theft. It's that's kind of actually talked about more in the extortion commentary a little bit. How states kind of divide.
But mostly it's like case law, right? Like, you know, people just throw out consent and then they leave it to case law.
Yeah.
So, oh, we said consent, but what we really mean is, you know, true consent, not consent obtained. So we wanted to bring that into the statute, but without tripping ourselves up even worse.
I don't know if it's helpful, but one thing that confused me is, like, when you're talking about offenses, you're talking about, like, lacking consent. And then you're defining things in terms of having consent by fraud or coercion. So that kind of...
Right.
So that was something that I found helpful after many conversations. But yes, being in the definition would be helpful on that point too, maybe.
So my substantive thing that I wanted to hear what other people thought, and Katja and I talked about it, and I thought she also had a different way of addressing my problem that I thought was a really interesting suggestion. But this had to do with, so starting with, for example, the sort of the prepayment card, and looking at, how do we do it? For maybe it's the definition of value, that it has to do, if you have a line in the definition of value that says, if it's just the card, notwithstanding subsections A or B, fair market value and different ways of valuing it, the value of a payment card, I said prepayment card, that's clearly not the term, a payment card is blank. So, and you talk, when you explain that, you talk about that is an effort for proportionality of just like stealing the card, not what you buy with it, whatever. So along those same ideas, I think that... a person's labor should have a blank, should be valued at a set amount. So labor fits in because labor is a part of services, and services is a part of property. So when we talk about theft of property, for example, hiring me to be your lawyer for an hour, and then you don't pay me, is theft of my labor.
And I think we ought to have theft of an hour of my labor be valued in terms of, right, what ends up mattering in theft is the distinctions between the gradations is about the value. If it's more than 2,500, it's this. If it's more than 250, it's this. And I think that it should not be that stealing an hour of my labor, theft of an hour of my labor, gets somebody a higher degree felony, and stealing an hour from not paying their cleaning person that they don't pay a lot ends up being a lower felony or a misdemeanor. That's wrong.
I don't understand, because why should stealing a car that's worth $25,000 get you a greater penalty than stealing a car that's worth $24,000? I mean, isn't it a fact that when you steal somebody's labor, it varies. Labor varies according to the specialty and what the expertise and what the costs are. And just like property is valued, services are valued. So why should there be a standard value to services? I don't understand.
So I don't suggest this for some kind of restitution. I don't think that it is more criminal, more bad, to steal an hour from a lawyer than it is to steal an hour from a cleaning person. In fact, I think stealing from the cleaning person will get you to hell faster. So I would reverse it for real. But at a minimum, I think it should be the same. I do not think
taking an hour of my time, the same argument for a car.
Well, okay.
We value a car according to its fair market value. I happen to drive a 2005.
Hold on. We're going to take bets on what kind of
Toyota Corolla stick. Okay? Now, you can't get another one that's in the perfect condition that my 2005 stick is in. Never had a day of a problem. I could not replace that car for what the fair market value in this statute says, because it is worth more to me than $3,000 or whatever the blue book says it is, because I could not spend $3,000. I think that is...
And we do make an effort to say cars are different.
There is still,
it's not, you could get, nobody might be willing to give you $1 for your car. And you're still going to get higher just because we're like, that's your car. That's important to you, even though it may be a piece of shit. Right? We actually do make some accommodation. It is also true that there is a proposal that my actually now nice new car, having driven the previous one into the ground, now I actually have a nice, relatively new one, I'm going to get the felony and you're going to get the whatever. That's true, and maybe I'll tackle that as well in the comments. But, so to throw out Koch's idea, because I was thinking set amount of money, and quite frankly I thought it should be minimum wage. But when I was discussing it with Katya yesterday, she had an idea of, instead of making it about money, making it about hours. That in the gradations, to account for this, to say an hour of my time is the same as an hour of yours, Dave.
Okay.
Right?
But and your point is that the loss of something can be more keenly, is more devastating, but the same amount could be more devastating for someone than for somebody else, right? And so if you have very little money and you're living close to the bone, a cut of the same depth is going to cut into the bone, right? That's the general intuition. And so if you're living on the fat of the land, there's a lot you could lose before it starts to hurt you. And so the harm that you do to a person who is making $1,000 an hour is different from the harm that is done.
But to me, that is the reverse. That is, punish the person who steals from the cleaning person more. I wasn't there. Right. I more felt that when we're coming up with these gradations and this is your prison time, that I do not think it is criminally worse to steal from somebody who happens to make more money.
Right.
I don't think that's criminally worse.
So then, but this is the only thing that I would, I would have two pieces of caution. One is that, given that most crime occurs between people of little means, that the
burden of that increased penalty for a crime against a person of little means is going to fall on people of little means disproportionately. So I'd be very concerned about any kind of scaling that actually ends up harming the if there were some other way of scaling such that the relative power and authority of a person is taken into account. So if you are some corporate police ball who's redlining people in the inner city, or you're stealing from them via some, you know, private university that just rips them off and then, you know, pulls them into debt, then that makes sense, right? The relative strength and ability and capability of a person to do that is, I think, should be taken into consideration at sentencing or so on and so forth. But I really worry that if you're penalizing people who are harming the people of low income because they have to work more hours to regain that value, you're also going to be burdening the offenders who are relatively low income disproportionately.
Well, so I brought the I'm bringing the idea partly because it may or may not end up in our final comments, but I sort of wanted to hear whether everyone was like, oh yeah, that makes total sense, or no, it doesn't. So I was putting it out there for that. So my original idea, just to say, so
which offense do you want?
So I'm looking at theft, but it really goes, but it
pick it, just once we will.
So page 9. Page, chapter, report 9, chapter 3, right? Okay. First degree theft.
What page?
Page 3.
Right, okay, that's
right. Right, so aggravated is value of 250,000 or more. That is, you know, anyway for me. But, you know, I suppose there are people that make that much money in like a time that you could steal from them. First degree, right, the property has a value of 25,000 or more. So I was accepting these gradations, right, more than 2,500, 250 or more, or some value. I was accepting these gradations, and my first suggestion was to say, basically, you figure out the value of what got stolen from me, the labor. You figure out that value, so it fits in here, by my time the minimum wage. The DC has a minimum wage. That's like a set time in the law that at some point maybe gets adjusted. So it's not like we say it's $50 and then 50 years from now everyone's like, that's crazy. But it might move over time. But it is a real thing that at the time, minimum wage was this. You took an hour from me. Well, that's whatever minimum wage is. So if you disagree with Dave, right, I'm screwed. I make a lot more than minimum wage. Thank God. It's just a number that clearly we're willing to be, like, say this is what some people make. And it says it's just not worse. It's just, to me, I was just trying to bring the lawyer and the person who cuts my grass or whatever to say, steal from either one of them. It's an hour of their time. Katja's idea was to not use this, right? That it would be first degree theft is stealing, 40 hours of somebody's labor, right? It's the property has a value of $25,000 or more. The property, in fact, is a motor vehicle. The property, in fact, is 40 hours of labor. Something like that, that is an hour of my time is the same as an hour of somebody else's. It's time that you stole from me, right? And so it doesn't matter that the cleaning person makes less. She lost 8 hours. I lost 8 hours, and I get paid more. And then we sort of say, you know, we grade it that way. I thought that was an interesting suggestion. So I'm throwing out the ideas for people to reject entirely or push my thinking on.
Of the lesser includeds of theft, how many does services work for? I mean, is that receiving stolen services? You know, is there, what are the LIOs of services of theft?
I don't know that there are any. I mean, we have...
Not true LIOs, just because of the elements test under current law.
That's what I was assuming. So I guess it would help me think of putting this through. If theft did not deal with services.
With labor. Because services,
that's right, with
is
labor.
Broader.
That's right, with labor. That we had just a different offense for theft of labor, and that we could then focus on the theft of labor offense as opposed to trying to mush it into the theft statute if it's not necessary for any of the other offenses.
But I would just say one thing, like services applies to any offense that uses property. So it's just because services is defined as being part of property. So it's not.
So what else? You could have it in extortion. You could have
fraud.
In lots
fraud
of
would be the case where these cases would probably actually be fraud, right?
Yeah. You could have it, but again, and this is under current law, right?
Yeah.
So current law, property, and this not so helpful definition of services that we have that includes labor, includes all these, but it's a non-exclusive list, right? Like, so it's you know, it helps maybe a bit, but this is all trying to mirror current law in what we did. And I guess the other point I'd make is, you know, I mean, we can look more into this, but you know, I'm not aware of a precedent in another jurisdiction that handles this way. Not to say that we couldn't, but there is frequently theft of services in the, you know, maybe two dozen or so jurisdictions that have kind of heavy model penal code theft provisions. Theft of services is a distinct version of theft. But it is, again, if you remember, we talked about this before, like, you know, they say there are many different types of form or means of committing theft, one of which is theft of services that they statutorily describe, but they're all treated the same for statutory purposes. So the district has never pulled out theft of services in a distinct way, except for theft of utility services, putting that aside. But which is kind of its own weird thing. A lot of regulatory kind of stuff there. But besides that, we've just lumped it in traditionally with part of the 1980 Theft Act with property. And so we don't have as much specificity about this. Like, I think it often is just, you know, it's kind of like intellectual property. People don't, you may not normally think of property in theft cases as having intellectual property and services, all of these. That said, right, what we've done would just follow current law. I'm not aware of kind of this in other jurisdictions.
So you're only talking about theft of services.
Theft of labor.
My first thought
from the last meeting was we should be pulling out theft of services. This seems wrong. Then realized, actually, it really is theft of labor.
Yeah.
And then thought, it plays out potentially in other places.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe you pull it out. Maybe it matters in these other places. Why aren't we just... I don't object to labor being part of services, being part of property. I object to how... It's like doing something with damage, right? It's like, well, but we need to... I would propose we have to have a way of valuing it that isn't about... I got a raise, and therefore, woohoo!
But you're not suggesting a revamping of all this of value.
You just want to carve out really for just labor and just labor in these offenses where theft or.
I thought the easiest thing. I was inspired by what you did with value having to do with payment card, and so I was going to propose. But I'm throwing the idea out to see what people think. If I'm crazy, whatever, I'm willing to hear it. To have like a D. So now I'm on report 8, page 6. You've got A, fair market value. B, if you can't figure out fair market value, do it this way. Da 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 da. And then you've got C, notwithstanding subsections A and B, the value of a payment card is blank. And the value of an unendorsed check is blank. And I thought, well, why not a D that says, notwithstanding subsections A or B of this section, the value of a person's labor shall be. The minimum wage times the time that was stolen, something like that.
Do we know how often this was prosecuted and what time?
I was just going to ask you that, Dave.
We don't have juveniles to steal labor. So you got to speak to USAF.
Well,
they may steal other things, the labor.
And my guess is rare. Like codes, there's no way for us to sort this out. This is just going to be purely anecdotal, whatever USAF can tell us.
Given the numbers we have here, what that would basically do is knock everything down to like a third or fourth degree theft, no matter what else was going on. Well, we may be anyhow. I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I don't know when you steal somebody's labor, when we're ever going to get to $250,000 in labor, whether the labor is. versus open.
I don't associate.
I drive a 2005.
So we hear.
You know, when are we going to get over a second degree anyhow in labor, whether it's true labor or whether it's minimum wage labor? Yeah. I mean, what is the impact
I think
of
the,
either?
Yeah, I think the impact depends on, like, right, are you pegging it to minimum wage, and then we multiply it out, and then we find out, oh, we could set that value wherever we want, right? Like, it's arbitrary. But your point is, like, well, how exactly would it play out?
How would it ever come out that it may matter that I charge $150 an hour versus $8 an hour, and we're going to come up above $2,500?
I agree.
When does that
think it is something that we should follow up and try to, at least, again, anecdotally, hear from USAO when this has arisen. I pulled up the human trafficking section, too, because it occurs to me that, like, you know, to the extent they're doing this, you know, is it immigrant labor, right? You know, who you just, you know, stiff for their work, thinking they won't report it, right? I don't know what kinds of cases they see or get, but it may be a very specialized, like, it may be, I just don't know, right? Like, where this is occurring. It also strikes me that, like, so, like, we might be able to do, like, this with the idea that this is targeting a particular problem that we see, right? Like, right, you know, picking up guys from Home Depot and then just letting them, you know, cutting them, you know, and it's construction site managers who are doing this repeatedly,
right.
And that's where the, you know, like, if so, then we might have, like, a more particular,
right?
What are we aggregating?
Right. Yeah. So the another approach, though, so that's a kind of a very targeted thing, depending on what we see. The other, but what you're opening is also, like, you know, maybe this is where Don was going. It's like the broader rationale, it strikes me, that it's, again, it kind of more as to the nature of the harm, right? Which is the harm is greater. The harm to the victim, the property owner, is greater depending on their relative circumstances. And that is something which does have, you know, like, right? Like, if Dave only has his one car and you steal his one car, that's a lot worse than, you know, Katya's five cars
but
that she's
that's
got in the garage.
Right, that's why I got confused, because I thought you were trying to replace all of value with a labor value.
Because that...
so I was like,
exactly.
So the sense in which, like, I mean, the principle that
the
you're
rationale
getting at
works.
Is,
yeah.
It right. is a larger one, right? You yeah. can imagine a theft regime where it was, like, assault, significant financial, serious financial deprivation, significant and regular. And Juno and I have had this conversation at least, like, twice every year for the last 5 years, that, like, that is, like, at the end of the day, what we really care about. But as a matter of administrative feasibility, let's say, it's just a lot easier to pick value numbers, notwithstanding the fact that, right, that creates some you know, extreme variations in terms of relative value. But what, you know, the point that you're making in the context of theft of labor is, you know, at least one way, particularly if you have this kind of, like, just, you know, standardized approach, that, you know, you could try and give that principle recognition.
So I will point out to another, maybe goes a ways towards the, I think, the value you're talking about. Actually, I'll pull it up on the screen. It's so, you know, we have, and this, again, reflects current law, we have this alternative maximum fine based on pecuniary loss or gain. I don't know how much, you know, this might be a model, but, like, let me pull it up here. Sorry. 2284A.
That's an indefinite.
So in our when we describe fines, right?
Penalty provisions.
So it wasn't in. This is earlier. You know, so we've got fines. We generally make it correspond. This class means this level of fine. But then we do go out of our way and reflecting current law to say, okay, subject to whatever maximums that will make somebody destitute or, you know, deprive them of sufficient means for reasonable living expenses. If the offense of conviction results in pecuniary loss to a person other than the defendant, obviously, or if the offense of conviction results in pecuniary gain to any person, a court may basically adjust the fines, right? So, again, this
how would this, we should probably think more, how this intersects with property offenses at all. But I think it is kind of this basic proposition that at least with respect to that you, existing law does provide some elasticity to increase the punishment where, the financial harm is greater. Now, pegged to the particular person, but that would be just, in some sense, one step further. Like, we've already kind of shown this elasticity in, like, the punishment we're willing to give here, and really this is, I think, premised on more generally actually non-property offenses, I think, you know, or
this applies to everyone.
Yeah, I'd have to look more at the legislative history on this.
I should also note, I mean, I don't know the frequency in D.C., but, like, I know, for example, in Florida, like, half of the federal court docket is just filled with Fair Labor Standards Act claims, which provide a mechanism for recouping these restitution of this nature.
So, right. So there's civil remedies, too, to think about. But anyway, I wonder.
These are fines.
These are fines only. Yeah. And I just wonder, like, if there's a way to also somehow, yes, tinker with this in a way to also help reflect that the harm is greater if it's theft of a I don't know how far you want to pursue this, but it does seem like
right.
a broad rationale,
you know,
and
so
a broad
we've got,
concern.
So we've got three different things. Yeah. I was willing to have everybody treated the same and pick a number, and then I was like, make it minimum wage.
Yeah. Okay.
And then if people don't like it, they can make the minimum wage higher.
Yeah.
But you know, and Dave sort of says, it is worse. Steal the expensive car? Well, you steal the expensive car. You steal from the lawyer who charges a lot? Well, you stole from the lawyer who charges a lot.
Yeah.
And the not necessarily that he was proposing it, but the at least prompted, Don did, the idea of the reverse, which is it is. You cut to the bone.
Yeah.
That's worse. You go to jail for longer if you treat somebody that way. The harm is greater. I don't know what Dave said, but I could live with either. I mean, I sort of feel like In the end, I'm on the defense side, which is the defendant, and thinking about one of the goals is supposed to be proportionality, and it just didn't seem proportional to me. It is proportional in a sense. I just think it just seems wrong that that's not the way I think proportionality should work. So, I do not think it is more time in prison because you stole from a rich person. I think that's but for taking their expensive car. But, you know.
We do make the exception for vehicles and the theft gradations.
Slightly.
Right.
But
it's not really.
But even with the really expensive watch versus the Timex, right? Like, we do it, forget the cars. It's just, I have nicer stuff, right, than a poor person. And you took my really good watch. Well, that's a felony, and you took somebody's cheap whatever. Well, that's a misdemeanor. Like, okay, I'm living with that. But this just seemed particularly offensive to me.
So one other thing I'd just say, because it kind of gets raised, I think, by these issues, is, and Donna touched on, like, right, you know, like, whether guidelines could, those of you on the sentencing commission, address these factors. But as a statutory matter, right, like, you know, there are jurisdictions that, look, this gets more to, like, you know, kind of discretionary standards and factors to consider, right, in sentencing. But that's another place that this could find a home in not with respect to any particular statute, but, you know, right now we have in Title 23, you know, the general language about, you know, consider rehabilitation and, you know, these different values that will, you know, the sentence will reflect. Well, this is kind of a fundamental issue you're raising about the disproportionate harms to indigent, not just indigent, but you know, like maybe there's a way to address it more broadly by statute, again, in as a factor in sentencing.
Well, let me throw out this. So I've been contrasting the lawyer and the cleaning person.
Right.
But, you know, it's us little government workers versus the, right? Like, you steal an hour of my legal time versus an hour of one of the new PDS lawyers. I make more money than that. Like, are you going to say how much? So what's your salary? How much do you make an hour, right? And versus the junior person in your office versus the person who, right, the hour of the senior partner at, you know, blah 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 expensive law firm, and whether really, right, that those are going to be these big differences. They charge a fucking lot, mm-hmm. right? And really, that's the felony versus an hour of money. You know, it's just, that's crazy. So only to say the services are the same. It's an hour. They got me, and I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll do your will for an hour. You know, it'll take me an hour.
But
and then you don't pay me. Yeah. But because
yeah, we have the services are the same though, because there's a reason I earn more than a new person. My hour is more valuable to the organization than their return.
Right, but in the end, but your hour, but you're also, you work in a place that doesn't pay sort of what you're worth. Do you think? Versus the partner.
I choose not to go on record discussing this.
That is paid more, yeah. more than their worth, let's be for real, right? Some little just out of law school is making a shitload more than you are. Seriously?
Well, another way we might be able to do this, I'm going to say I'm proposing, is to cap it as opposed to break it down, as opposed to doing it that way. Because I hear your point. I mean, I do. But again, to cap the amount of labor that goes into it at a certain point. And then I think, maybe. But again, I don't know how it actually ever plays out. We could be arguing about all of this,
right.
And it could never be more than a second degree
okay.
ever in the history of right. D.C. government, because that it would be a $2,500.
My guess is the biggest way this, I can imagine, again, whether this is ever actually a process, you know, a fraud claim, right, where it's, you know, using fake identity, perhaps even, right, you know, you. Order something that requires, you know, extensive labor. Somebody performs the service, puts in however many hours, and, you know, expecting to be able to bill, but no, you can show up front through the use of a false persona. There was intent from the get-go to defraud this person of that time and labor. That could run into thousands and maybe tens of thousands. So maybe we are talking about, like, you know, felony level or you know, not lowest level felony. So it seems the potential there. My guess is in practice, these cases just don't get brought. But we can check.
Yeah, I mean, with labor of that value, right, probably there's going to be plenty of civil remedies. But you know, when it comes to, like, ordinary sector services, like, the harm isn't that I've lost services. It's really that I've lost the compensation for those services. I think that's sort of the basic rationale for why it doesn't make sense just to rely on the fair market value of the person's labor.
Yeah, because if they weren't working on your 3 hours, they would be working on somebody else's 3 hours and getting paid.
And it would have been a certain amount.
Right.
It would have been a certain amount of money.
That's the rationale for the difference. Good. Well, I think it's an important perspective too, like a broader one. So it's
PDS is for the people. We're still going to
there. You go. All right.
Well, I'm for the people. $2,500 is too low for cars. No, I really do. I think cars are different, and I think replacement cars are different. And so we would suggest that amount for cars are valued differently.
Great.
The difference.
Well, my car is up here. Well, so I'm good.
I will say on the car
just
point,
don't tell my wife.
Since it came
cars
up,
isn't.
You know, the idea was just to have a floor, right? That because most cars presumably are going to be under 25,000 or not far above 20, like the primary options that, you know, would normally fall in here is the 25 to 250,000 or the 2,500 to 25,000. So we wanted to narrow that band and just make clear that, like, also, like, the theft of the dilapidated old car that's hardly worth anything, the people who usually have those cars, it is exactly the people who need them the most.
That's right.
So there was some sense that we're boosting in some sense at the bottom. You know, it's not going to be this, like, to get at least up to the kind of the minimum, presumably felony level, although we haven't, you know, matched this all up.
But that's sort of my argument. Actually, yeah. I made a note to see if I could check what the values of these cars are. You say, my gut tells me 2,500 ain't getting you anything.
Yeah, which is the reason
why I think that for cars that value is too low.
It'd be great if there was any empirical anything. Like, I don't know how to. You might have a connection that could.
Dave, what are you
call
saying?
Somebody up to DM. You know, I don't know how.
What
to
I'm saying is
find that out.
Is okay. First degree is 25,000 or more, a vehicle of 25,000 or more, right? Mm-hmm. If I don't make the cutoff, I'm sorry, I said 2,500. But if I don't make the cutoff of 25,000, mm-hmm. I'm down at, I am the equivalent of a $2,500 otherwise theft, is what I was trying to say. Whereas I think that they're put on par. And what I'm saying is you're saying, we're putting it on par so that any value is it. And what I'm saying is, it's actually probably more, it's probably worth more to the person, the average person who drives a car like I do, that value would be more than 2,500. So.
Am I right in saying your solution would be to raise the floor a bit for cars so that, like, so for instance,
that's exactly where
we have right now second degree theft. We say
any car.
Yeah.
So then you have maybe five.
No. I think what Dave is saying is that for first degree theft, it's either 25,000 or more, or any car.
Or any car worth more than 10,000. So that's
yeah. Okay.
So you don't have to go straight from a 25,000 to any value.
25,000 is too high
for most people who drive cars.
Yeah.
Northwest aside, the people I hang out with in D.C. don't drive $25,000 cars.
That's right, and you know, but it's those are mainly the two boxes. It's like,
which
and
is
again,
why I said it the way we just phrased it, which is that or a car of X value.
Sure. Yeah, and we could definitely review that if you have any kind of like
because actually otherwise it doesn't make sense to even have a two. Because the property would be $25,000, whether it's a vehicle or not.
Right, and that's why we had put that in there, was just to, we debated whether to put in that let me pull it up on the screen. So
you don't have to go through it, I'm just saying, I get it.
I would agree if you measure the car in the hours that the person has.
Okay.
Good.
I get a bunch of other little...
Sure, and happy to go anywhere. Laura, did you have? Was there? Any,
I got nothing.
That was your. That was your.
No, I bet when I do my homework in chapter 10 tonight, I'll be like, "Ooh,
you'll have,
too late."
You'll have many more things. Okay.
Okay. So yes. My next one was on UUVs on page 21.
Okay.
And I made this note late at night, so if it's something really obvious, I apologize for wasting your time. But for an operator of the vehicle, what's the difference between first and second? What's the elements difference?
Okay, so you're on page 21, and you're wondering, operator of a vehicle, what's the difference between
first degree and second?
Second degree is your plea offense.
I actually was, Richard and I was reviewing this today, I flagged we should give some further thought or some more explanation to how it says operating in first, and then operating or writing.
Right.
And second, and there was some reason we did that, I believe, regarding unanimity, but I'm wondering if that was correct.
Right.
We really meant writing. So that could...
No.
Well, we meant to have it structured as a lesser included.
Right.
And so the thought was in general that what are we doing with UUV passenger? Are we like...
Let's leave the passenger aside, because I want to talk about that separately.
But
if it's operating...
Yeah.
Is there any elements difference between first and second?
You would satisfy elements of both first and second if you're operating.
Okay.
Yeah.
Riding as a passenger, and this is probably when we get a lot of kick from the side, which I deserve probably. That's right.
She's preparing.
I only know juveniles with UUV passengers and UUV drivers, and I only know them better when I was defending them than when I was prosecuting them. But to me, the difference between the driver and the passenger tended to be which hour the police officer stopped the vehicle, as opposed to a culpability difference. The cars, my clients at least, they might have driven it, they happened to be a passenger at the time they got pulled over. Next time somebody else happened to get, my client happened to get behind the wheel 10 minutes before the cop pulled him over. So I'm wondering what the, and this is a change from current DC law, and so I'm wondering what the rationale is for changing current DC law for passengers.
Sure. Why have passengers lower than the operator?
Yes.
Right.
Except.
Right, and to current law, it's the same.
True, but I have a vague recollection of being in juvenile court where you couldn't get a consent decree if you were the driver.
And that went and came, and but those things are, I don't want to call them random. I will call them responsive to the community needs at the time, and there were offenses, even though they were one statute for drivers and passengers, there was a time where we got instructions not to give consent decrees for drivers.
So as far as you know right now, there's not particular difference in terms of...
Yes, and I could go back and verify with my office, because maybe things happen that I'm aware of, but I don't know that there's really different.
And it would be interesting to hear from Renata. I mean, that is, you know, that was, I certainly can remember the move from juvenile to adult court and being shocked at how much time it carried in adult court, because it's such a random little juvenile thing, and then you're like, oh, damn, they take it seriously in adult court.
Yeah, but I go back far enough from,
but I can't
Christmas
remember a big
motion,
driver or...
So one issue to flag just to think about is that I would assume in almost all instances in which you're a passenger, you're also an accomplice of UUV regular, right? Because your comp's liability is either assistance or encouragement, and you're desiring to facilitate. So it's just a question as to if this is what we go with, we would want to be clear that you can't get the passenger for both being an accomplice to a first degree UUV and also as committing second degree UUV. You wouldn't want to facilitate that. So if you're going to keep the degrees separate, you want to also make like clear through the statute that sort of double conviction is not possible.
No, and I agree there shouldn't be a double conviction. I'm unaware of us ever doing that. But that to me weighs in favor of not making a distinction, because then it's talk about your, you know, transparency. That's just the charging decision based on the exact same facts that changes the outcome. And if you knew that, it should be straight up in the statute.
Yeah,
so that's my comment on that one. Do it as you choose.
You bet. And I will note, you know, two things. You know, one is you probably know, like, you know, the history of UUV passenger is a muddy one through case law, right? And it in part goes to accessory liability.
It started out as accessory.
And then it kind of morphed, and eventually over time got recognized. Right. It's never been kind of statutorily... you would not think reading the UUV statute that it includes, you know, that liability. We've looked some at other jurisdictions. We can go back and look again.
Yeah.
You know, as like to the extent that the norm is to cover that sort of conduct at all. You know, I think, you know. We have an unauthorized entry of a motor vehicle offense, right, which presumably would overlap with UUV. So you've got liability there already. But, you know, our sense was that this is, without assuming that the passenger was a driver, that might be true. Maybe it could even be proven up. I don't know, you know, but that it is less serious conduct than actually driving. But you know, that's a culpability kind of distinction. Again, because this has never been you know, it's ever been before the council, it's ever been, you know, like, it... it
that's why I don't think we should change it.
Well, well, I hear you, but, you know, if we left everything that's just a matter of case law frozen where it is, we'll be in other trouble and other things.
So. Like Richard said, if you were able to prove that the juvenile or whoever in the back seat was actively egging on the driver or who was taking the wheel or had just been driving, you could prove that the first degree UUV under accomplice liability. I think it really is just to clarify what is ambiguous a bit under the statute and current law, that if you're literally, the evidence is you are sitting in the back of a car as a
that
passenger.
That you know to be stolen. Yeah.
But that is all you're doing, and maybe you didn't have an opportunity to hop out. There's this whole idea of
that's a separate issue about the...
But if that's
but
the
that
case,
goes to whether you knew and at what point you knew. And we're premising, that's a proof question in order to prove the crime. That's something I may have to rebut. But that's not a question of whether, you know, to make the base of the elements of the offense, all I have to do is prove that you were in a vehicle and you knew it was stolen, right? You knew you were driving without the permission of the owners. It's the way the UUV is.
Yep. And I think, you know, right, I'm trying to think if we have any comparable offenses. Anybody has an idea where, you know, again, it's essentially right. It is kind of an accomplice. You know, there's another person has to be involved.
There's theft and RSV. I mean, I was thinking a little bit. It's not completely equivalent, but there's a sense in which receiving stolen property is considered to be less culpable than taking stolen property. You may get an analogy here that in a sense, the person who's riding in the car is kind of like the receiver, whereas the person driving it is the taker. I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, but there is some basis for recognizing that distinction.
Yeah, I guess the other point is, and then we'll let it go, is I don't know that people steal things so that the receiver can receive it as much as I think people driving in cars together is more of a joint activity.
So there might be a conspiracy charge.
Yes, which is all the more reasons why I would rather it be transparent and not have to do an aider and abettor or a conspiracy or something else and just have it the same, because then we know everybody's treated the same and it's not a charging decision that affects the penalty.
Right. So
that's exactly why I don't want it to be different.
Because you don't want to have to bring a conspiracy charge.
And then be accused that sometimes you bring conspiracies and sometimes you don't bring conspiracies, and there goes the transparency, and this purpose of this exercise is to have transparency, and therefore the offense should do it. We shouldn't be relying on those other theories to get a basic offense that's already laid out in the code, right? Isn't that, every time we say transparency, isn't that what we mean?
And so the gradation here would be between people who are guilty of UUV and then people who are guilty of theft, of auto theft and UUV.
Yes, because the reason UUV, to my knowledge, was created is because people who steal the cars don't hold on, traditionally have not held on to them for long periods of time, and in fact flip hands many, many times in very short periods of time.
So I would just say that even if you get rid of the distinction, you're still going to have the same problems. There's nothing stopping a prosecutor from bringing a conspiracy charge or an additional charge of UUV premised upon an accomplice liability theory with or without the gradation.
So, but if I do it based upon accomplice liability, what's the penalty?
No, it's the same.
You'd
be getting hit with two counts of the equivalent of the first degree offense.
I think they would merge. I don't know that we could.
Well, so I will say
It gets you the same price, so it would be a waste of time to do that.
Right. I mean, but I think Michael's point is valid. You know, another way in terms of clarity is to eliminate, which is where things were originally, right, in the case law, eliminate UUV passenger as a separate offense and just have the accessory liability, right? So then you at least have that kind of clarity and consistency. That's how we charge it, right? Like, you're the passenger, and you're an accessory to this offense, so you are, again, would get the same penalty as the UUV.
We understand what the accessory penalty is sure.
yet. So
yeah, but no, so, but so, under so current law, that's how
just
it would
to be
work.
Clear, complicity is not a general like a general inchoate offense in the sense that you have a general penalty scheme. Complicity theory is a theory of liability, so it's a way of attributing someone else's conduct to another person. So the penalty is, I mean, you could come up with a creative way, and many people have argued, and it's intuitive that you would make that distinction statutorily. But in terms of how standard practice is across 50 states, it's just you've been convicted of another person's conduct via complicity theory, so the statutory maximum is the same.
All of which say, like, oh, we're not yet fully to penalties. We don't foresee a change to the existing law, and the existing would, you know, just be, make it equivalent. So
we can move on.
Yeah, I mean, no, but it, yeah, and it, and it's an important point. It's a thorny thing. So yeah. What
okay.
else?
One minor comment in the what do you call it in the commentary on page 22, the last sentence of the first full paragraph, the subsection 82.
Page 22, subsection
A2. Yeah, we're still on unauthorized use of your motor vehicle. It ends, requiring the QPQs to be aware to a practical certainty desire that the item is a motor vehicle. And again, this was one that was late at night, so it might not make sense. If what was stolen was an ATV, is it consciously designed that the item is a motor vehicle or that it's an ATV? I'm just curious.
Fair point. I think we would just say it's kind of a motor vehicle, which is to say one wouldn't have to identify the distinct
distinction between
right or of all these things. Right. You would just right. You just have to know in general that it is a motorized vehicle of whatever sort.
Oh yeah, shoplifting, page 33. Sorry.
Nope, shoplifting. 33.
Okay, so shoplifting A2, personal property that is displayed, held, stored, or offered for sale. And I was thinking about that because sometimes, you know, like Bath and Body Works sometimes have things that say offered for sale, and then they put up the new display, and they take the old display down, which is no longer offered for sale. It's last week's. It's not part of the Christmas display anymore. If it's no longer offered for sale, then it can no longer be shoplifting. It has to be theft too.
Wait, what do they do with it?
They ship it up.
Let's talk about
my son worked at a Bath and Body Works. That's why the thing came to me. So they ship it up and they send it back to the warehouse the next Christmas or where, whatever the hell.
But so it has to be. You're saying that the displayed held, stored, and offered all modify sale.
Well, that's the question.
Well, it does, because if it's on the truck, it's not. It doesn't count. Right. Merchandise on a truck. But
it doesn't mean it's not theft. It just means it's not shoplifting.
So what is it if I steal
theft.
All the stuff that used to be
theft? And quite frankly, they ought to be thanking you for it, because they were just going to pay the storage, and it's crap anyway, right?
It has a good value. No, but seriously, and the reason I'm raising this is actually for a reason I thought you would like, which is, shouldn't the prosecutor be able to charge him with shoplifting rather than theft too, if it was available for sale and is no longer available?
I'm not clear on the hype one. Sorry. So you have a display of stuff at Bath
and Body. Okay. So and it's the Christmas display.
Yeah.
And
it's Christmas stuff for sale. Christmas merchandise for sale. It's seasonal, but it's not Halloween candy, which I threw out because you can't keep the Halloween candy. You put
That's
it on
right.
sale now. But it's something where you're like, we've got room for storage. We'll bring it out next year and sell it again. It's the Santa outfit.
I think that would still be, if it's like stored in the back of the store,
That no, it's bad. It's a warehouse. I don't know what they do.
Then
what
I don't think that would be shoplifting anymore. Because that actually comes from DCCA case law. The Harris decision did construe the shoplifting statute to cover, and I quote, extend at least to merchandise held in reasonably close proximity to the customer area and intended for profit.
Oh, no, I remember the case. And that was the stuff where the stuff was in the back room, right? It was on the other side of the door, and they hadn't yet, like, unpacked it or whatever. Yeah. They were going to bring it out at some point. No, I agree. I don't...
Wouldn't it benefit the defense if we could charge for shoplifting, not for theft too?
Yes, I think it actually is better. I think it gives the prosecution an option to charge a lesser included. Well, if people don't like it, I'm just bringing it up.
I think that would be, though, we'd have to be clear. That is, I think that'd be a change of
so like,
okay, just sort of clear. Yeah. Anything that is shoplifting can be prosecuted as theft. There's no...
Right, but Dave's right. We'd rather have the shoplifting.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like is or was
displayed,
held, stored, or offered for sale. Is or was.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with his was. Right. I don't know how
argue,
or not.
You could also then argue that it's being held for sale in a future time, too. It really just depends. Like, there's not a lot of...
No, but you say if it's on the truck.
But that's when it's on a truck versus in, like...
The more basic point, I think, is
where the warehouse is.
Why do we have a shoplifting statute?
Yeah, that's the real thing.
Right? Which is to say, from our perspective, in terms of reducing unnecessary overlap between offenses, right?
This would just make almost all of
Yeah, the so exactly. Like, it, like, to keep it, it was all, besides... whatever penalty difference there may or may not be. And again, we haven't dealt with penalties, so like it may be that whatever, a 16th degree theft is the same as shoplifting, and they're the same, right? So like maybe that doesn't matter. Is it all about the penalty? Because in having a lower plea down offense in certain cases, it seems to us that that is the case. That
shoplifting doesn't sound as bad,
and how it shows up on your record, etc. Now the danger for that though, right, is that it's the inconsistency, right? So like why in some cases
to the back of the store and I load all of the things that might be for sale at some point into the truck, right? My big tractor trailer right when I drive away.
That's
shoplifting.
Yeah, I mean, in general,
I'm impressed.
Yeah,
right. At some point, we need to be able to differentiate and hopefully have consistent charging on this, right? Because then you do get it. Why is this group of people getting the lower shoplifting charge? But the if they are different. A different charge is being brought in other cases. If it's purely a matter of prosecutorial discretion, right? Because the elements otherwise totally overlap. That is something we're in general trying to do is reduce unnecessary overlap. Now, is this if it is necessary because of a proportionality concern, and that we it's important to have a lower plea down offense with a different name. That's a rational decision. If there's nothing else, I mean,
again, I'm not. It's not one I'm losing sleep over. I just wanted to point out that I thought that it was someplace
good.
That I don't know how the USAFL, but
sure.
I'd be willing to give.
And in current practice, I mean, right, it is bound by a store environment. Again, the outside of the case law may not totally be established. It includes the stuff beyond, but it may not have a hard outer boundary yet in the case law.
No, just so, it needs to be in reasonably close proximity to the customer area.
Yeah, that's right.
And readily available to customers as needed.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but I remember.
I just think that one thing about shoplifting that I will say is. Coming from Virginia, other states, they will consider shoplifting just as bad as larceny. So to go to the overlap issue again, like if a defendant leaves D.C. under current law with an RSP, a shoplifting, a theft, in D.C. it's considered one conviction under that statute in 22, 32, whatever. But in Virginia, he'll be considered to have three or four different shoplifting or three or four different larceny convictions, and that can seriously affect the criminal history score and the guidelines. So at best, we understood shoplifting as like a very narrow offense for this, like, where there might be some evidentiary issues specific to merchandise in the store, even though arguably theft is broad enough. So I don't know if you want to draw a harder line to make that clear or what have you.
Well, I think Dave raises an interesting point, and we should think about it. I do, you know, when you look at theft, you've got the difference. Third degree theft is 250 or more, and fourth degree is just some value. Yeah. So the kid who puts the candy bar in his pocket,
yeah,
if you don't have shoplifting, you've got fourth degree theft, and that's as bad as the person who steals $200 of something, $249. And that seems...
Is it the label?
Fucked up. Are we on the
is it, is both. Because
you know, another way to
relabel
that lowest level of theft.
Right.
It don't have to call it shoplifting. We call it taking $200 or less. I certainly recognize that, like, the name matters. You know,
but actually, but the shoplifting has other things in it, doesn't it? I mean, if you catch me merely swapping
right.
the tags on the
yeah.
sweater,
and that's where I think
and that's where the cop
yeah.
grabs you.
Yeah.
You don't have a completed theft.
That's right.
But arguably, you could. We've had this discussion too earlier. You would be exercising control over the property.
I've
missed
that one from some
judges and juries.
Okay.
Intent to
that
deprive,
it's a theft, and
or
all I did
take
was take the eggs from the large and the extra large and swap them. And I haven't even walked away from the dairy case yet.
But
whether that's theft,
you know. That could be your theft.
But it's shoplifting, right?
Exercising
Dave's still working
theft.
On his hypo.
But just to be
honest, Renata still wins.
Theft in the UP statutes or TPW are very broad in DC under the current law and the revised. So if you
yeah.
are just at the counter and you're switching price tags, you are either exercising control with intent to deprive or with intent to take or make use for your right under UUP. So it is covered.
I would say UUP, it's good to remind of that too. Like,
yeah.
you want to plea down offense for pretty much anything in this zone, UUP is probably going to be it as well. Again, with the notion that it, you know.
Or, too, I will say, Richard, one thing we had discussed is we had talked about and having a fifth degree of theft. You know, you'll have states that have.
Sure.
8 degrees of theft. I think, from my recollection, 4 and 5 are the most common. So you could have a fifth degree. There's no
it
reason.
It could be $50 or less, right?
It
like
could.
We could have the
and
real
some
de minimis
states will
type
have
of...
that. They'll have like 50 degrees, you know, something very de minimis to cover. Like you said, you're right. That is a good point that I need to remember that, you know, if you take the candy bar, that is not the same as $200 of stuff.
I'm not sure you're going to get a very warm reception. A bunch of us to remove shoplifting.
Sure.
So, you know.
Yeah, if de minimis theft was actually less of a serious charge than shoplifting, then you would have the kind of gradation that I think.
As long as it was clear
for,
that
right?
those other things weren't there and it wasn't left to be arguing to a judge or a jury that switching the large eggs for the extra large eggs is theft. You know, that's fine.
Yeah,
but I don't want that in the commentary.
Yeah.
Right now, it's in the code, right?
Yeah. Good. We'll think about this some more and see again, like, at the very bottom, and just say, like, if anybody in the written comments wants to put it, like, again, putting more gradations at the bottom or relabeling at the bottom end of theft, you know, that might address this in part. Another option that would kind of do this, you know, potentially do the same thing is extend shoplifting. But I'd also highlight that, again, UUP is out there and might be, you know, TBWR, it's used. We've seen it some in the numbers, but, like, not that much.
Yeah, not really.
And I don't know, you know, could be a lot of reasons why that is, right? It could be just training as it's on people's minds at all, right? And so, like, more clearly kind of structuring and, you know, unauthorized use of property as the lower, maybe that would help fill some of that space, too, but...
Okay, I say one potential other option too. You do see in some states is they will codify. We could do it in theft and even UUP. Some kind of evidentiary provision that says if you take control over property, I forget how it is. If you take control of property and you don't pay, there's it gives rise to an inference of intent to deprive, and that's how some states work essentially de facto shoplifting into their theft statutes is through a special evidentiary provision to cover any possible concern that theft and UUP don't
without having a separate
without having a separate offense. It's like an evidentiary provision that's in there to address any possible concerns, just as another option.
Yeah, and that's inferences are from a jury instruction perspective.
They can't be charged
correctly.
Yeah. No, I know, and we're
Okay, so my next little one is page 39, unlawful creation or possession of a recording.
Yes.
Okay, so just a couple of questions. In A4, what's the difference between gain and advantage? When do I have one and not the other?
Oh yes.
I think we just kept that because it's the current language.
So that is a carryover. I didn't check.
I believe we added rent in, but otherwise it's largely the same.
Yeah.
Well, you're looking that up. Maybe someone else can. What's the importance of February 1572?
Federal copyright law.
Federal preemption for all
like,
this.
Up until I'll get it wrong. Basically, up until that date, only the musical notes on the page were copyright protected, but not the actual like sound. And so I'm not explaining. That is the date. It's actually in the federal statute. Like any recording.
I mean, I assumed as I read through when you didn't explain it, I was like, oh, they must.
And that's
this
in the current statute too.
That's why I became a mini copyright
expert. Yes, that is the date that federal copyright law extended protection to sound recordings. That is why.
Yeah. And they explicitly preempted state from protecting copyright audio copyright after that date. So
the current, Dave, the current is with intent to sell, to derive commercial gain or advantage, or to allow another person to derive commercial gain or advantage.
That's fine, but I had some question marks and I was trying to actually I had an advantage and not a gain.
You're probably entirely... We did add rent in, though, because that's what we've seen a couple of states, and it kind of makes sense. That's a way of gaining or having advantage. It isn't totally clear, I think, from use or sell, but other than that...
And then on definitions.
Oh, one example might actually clarify this, which is to say, there was some place, I don't know if it was in commentary or case I was on this, where it was like, one, it was about selling them or in gain getting more at some dollar value transfer, but then like the person who's using them or possessing them to help attract like customers, like there were some weird hypos about this, like
he advertised like we have 10,000 records to sell at our store, that guy only has 5,000, right? And
what?
Those 5,000 were, that'd be a commercial advantage but not necessarily commercial gain.
I think Richard is referring to, could we chat a bit about this, is that there's actually like, if it's like a bar or restaurant plays music in the background, it's actually like they're supposed to pay royalties, and there's actually like people who go
your
around.
Your little mixed
like, we'll
CDs that the bartender's playing like, above, like, no, not actually supposed to be doing that.
And it used to be every time you sang.
So that would be using it for commercial gain or advantage in a way that's not selling or renting it.
But the advantage is like not to have to hear that shit, right? And you're like, can I just get a one where there's just quiet so I can hear the person I went to dinner with?
Yeah. So this is like there is like some detailed origins of this besides like Rachel said that adding in rent,
I think we added
the standard-ish language that you see in all these jurisdictions. There was some model language that came out originally and
I think you do see this gain or advantage
so it connects at least with the case law in other jurisdictions that might flesh that out in some odd circumstances.
B1 audio visual recording, we have audio visual, which includes vision and sound, not pure vision. And we have sound.
That's right.
But why don't we have vision?
I think that's copyright,
it's
too.
It's a preemption thing again. Like,
it is preempted.
I believe
just vision, but not vision and sound?
There's. I'd have to review my research on this, what we did, and also it's helpful to look at it in tandem with the deceptive labeling. Because I think audiovisual recording here is limited to just live performance, which is fine.
A fixed series of related images and intrinsically.
And I think the audio visual recording.
Devices.
Right, but it's only in the offense, Dave, for an audiovisual recording of a live performance.
And I recall, also, too, this definition comes from the deceptive labeling offense.
Which is where we really.
I do believe. So, yeah, we might have made a few tweaks. We took the audiovisual recording definition from deceptive labeling, and I think I'd have to review the specifics, but the commentary tries to make clear that we extended the offense to audiovisual recordings of just live performances because it's currently ambiguous under the statute. So
this doesn't cover me going and recording, sitting in the movie theater.
Right. That's a separate
offense.
Which
we
have
to say, I think that was
it was a late breaking thing Yes, and so we didn't include with this group. But
we didn't. That is very common among states to go and not. And the way I understand it, again, becoming this mini copyright expert, that's not preempted under federal law. And what it's getting at is apparently people will go and make like bad recordings of movies on opening night and then sell them.
But again, what we criminalize and can legitimately do is the operation of a video camera. It has nothing to do with the actual recording because that's preempted. So all we can do is make illegal the operation of a video camera.
It's trickily worded. Like,
or we don't need to do it.
Yeah, or we don't do it at all. But again, we didn't get around to it this time.
Yeah, maybe. That is an interesting
question. So if I film the Blue Man group and have sound with them, that's a violation of statute? It's not a violation of statute. Even though what they're doing is the act.
That's interesting. I think
we'd have to look. Some states do. No, that's one thing. We didn't go there.
That's why I was saying the difference between visual and.
No, you're right. We didn't go there, I don't think, for this, because we were looking at more narrowly like what the current law is. But I do believe, I didn't analyze them fully, but other states will have full-blown like other offenses just for live performances. Mm-hmm. And that is something that our current statute just doesn't do. And this was a way of at least resolving the present ambiguity. But to go and have your hypo, I do believe would require like substantive changes that we could do. We just didn't do it for this.
It just seemed odd to me that we would have
the whole area.
We'll check the whole area because it's all working around the federal like preemption issues.
But that is certainly something we can look into live performances and what their protection should be because it's just not as simple as.
And that's why I picked the Blue Man group because, in a sense, the visual is it.
Yeah.
The sound doesn't. I mean. That to me shouldn't be the determinant for them.
Yeah, that's certainly something.
Yeah,
that
isn't there?
Well, there are many IP experts at GW. It is one of our strongest programs. So if you want to talk to someone who is an expert,
we have me. We
don't want to get blown out of the water either.
I do know that much. Okay. Like, some states will have expansive live performance statutes, and I imagine it's for this reason because it's not totally on point with sound recordings and like this whole thing. And so that's certainly something we can do, but it just wasn't for this first draft. Something that was on our radar necessarily.
And it's not in the current law, right?
No.
Okay. Page 49,
Arson. Oh, Laura's going to be sad she left.
Yeah.
Okay, so next one up.
Maybe she'll be glad she left.
All right. First one, the obvious thing, and I just want to make sure I'm reading it right, because knowingly starts a fire, knowingly goes to damages or destroys too.
That's
so right. Even though I'm going to knowingly start the fire, I have to knowingly know that I'm going to damage the property.
Be practically certain that it will result
in damage or
some destruction, right?
And if you're just reckless, that would be reckless burning.
That's right. So that you know.
Reckless as damage.
There's a whole other offense for
burning.
The lower mental state on that, but even there,
I'm afraid
it is
my son is going to be guilty of this.
Yeah,
he able to hold the matches. Yeah. He certainly won't want to damage or destroy, but
do you guys remember something about things attached to a motor vehicle?
Are we still in arson?
Yeah. He is still an arson. It was a motor vehicle, and I put a board attached to a motor vehicle to see commentary. And I don't see any commentary where that was.
There's stuff in the commentary about why motor vehicles like is now in the statute, but it doesn't sound like that would be what you're looking for?
If you're attached to a motor vehicle, I will say there was, we had at some point, right, like, what if it's like, you know, the tractor trailer with an attack, you know, like, is the trailer part of a tractor trailer part of the motor vehicle or not? Maybe that's what you were, I know we had some discussion at some point about that, and
I may have to come back.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm either.
Arson.
Are you thinking about a railroad car not connected to a motor vehicle?
No, I meant connected. It was the example I had, and I thought there was something in the commentary that triggered it, was things that are connected to a motor vehicle. So whether if you burn them, it was arson or not.
In UUV, we do, let's see if this is the other. Well, yeah, we talk about, we see the scope of the current UUV, this is page 22 at the bottom. The scope of the current UUV offense is limited to any automobile, self-propelled mobile home, truck, tractor with semi-trailer or trailer or bus.
Yeah, then don't worry about it. If you said motor vehicle, actually the definition of motor vehicle includes things like the semi-trailer.
Yeah,
that
I mean,
comes from the current definition.
Yeah, I don't think we were trying to do anything different.
I don't think we did. We kept that. The only thing we did was expand the scope to planes and stuff, and then added in the two cases.
That's right.
So I think otherwise it should be the same.
Yeah, so that should get swept in.
So the difference, and just so I understand how you're thinking about this, aggravated arson is only dwelling or building, right?
Yes.
And it's only, and you have to be reckless to the fact that there was a person in the building. But if you set the car on fire, knowing that there's a person in a car, then which degree of arson is that?
It would, I think, depend on, does motor vehicle in that instance satisfy dwelling or building?
No.
In that case, it wouldn't so much be arson. It's probably like aggravated assault or attempted to kill or
something. But I said a dwelling, building, business yards, watercraft, or motor vehicle.
Right.
So if I light a motor vehicle, it's arson.
That's right. You would get...
Nothing different if knowing that there was a person inside the vehicle, like knowing there was a person inside the dwelling. That just seems odd to me.
That's a good point. I think, you know, part of what's kind of interesting about all the arson distinctions, right, around dwellings or buildings, this kind of goes to burglary in terms of the, do you have a heightened expectation of privacy or security? But partly, again, as we kind of talked about also in, it comes up, you know, is the, like, the heightened risk, right? Can you get out? And, you know, certainly you can imagine circumstances where somebody gets locked in or pinned in a car and then you light it on fire.
Cars have gas tanks.
Sure.
And dwellings don't typically have gas
tanks.
So there is an increased risk to a person in a car if you light their car.
One thing with this discussion, even including motor vehicles and our arson statute period, is an expansion of district law, because currently motor vehicles are not included in arson.
This is
better, I guess, in that sense than the other. But I think, you know, to go what Richard was saying too, it's this idea of like where are you most likely to encounter people. And there's just, if you look at arson in the current DC case law, it's where there has to be a risk to people. Most cars aren't going to satisfy that. So I guess it would be a pretty hard line on this if you set a fire to a car.
Knowing the person, not reckless to the person.
You would get arson.
But actually knowing that there was a person.
You would get arson and aggravated assault or something.
And is that something that you would charge as arson before you charged it as ag assault or attempted murder? Or, you know, like, the facts that where you have a person, right, you know a person's in a car and you're, you know, lighting it on fire, it sure seems, you know, highly suggestive that you're trying, you know, whereas with a larger structure, you know, there's it's harder to make the claim, oh, I was just, you know, I was over here, I didn't, you know, I wasn't trying to assault, you know, this cause harm to this person because it's a larger structure. Whereas in a confined space to do something like this, it seems like you'd be walking into, you know, again, assault or maybe even attempted murder liability for an action which is
more serious than arson, really. I mean, our current law, arson is just 10, correct? Or 15, maybe?
10
in current law. So, yeah, it's an interesting distinction, but I think just looking at, you know, current district law, but like most.
Yeah, so we brought in motor vehicles, though.
We did. That's not in current
squarely
law at
for the
all.
First time. Yeah. Although, I'm not sure. I think it's.
Unless it's a dwelling.
It isn't in the statute, and I think, you know.
If you lit a car on fire under current district law that someone was using as a dwelling, it would be up to the court to decide whether or not that satisfies dwelling.
That's right. So somebody living out of their car.
Yeah, I know. I wasn't talking about somebody.
That's, yeah. Yeah,
but just the under current district law, you'd be getting NDP at most for the property damage.
This is another one, it may be a silly answer. Page 78, criminal damage to property. Do we all agree, because of the way that this is structured, that if you had a place of worship that was worth more than $250,000, it would be had criminal damage? And that the wording of worship in there is not mean to say that it doesn't appear. It is not included in the higher offenses.
Correct.
It is merely a floor, like what you're saying with you made.
That's right.
And that, I think, a sentence.
We should be consistent one way or the other.
That's right. And a sentence would be helpful.
Good.
There.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. And yeah, we should draft those consistently one way. You know, either they both are in the UUV style, and we kind of show. We didn't know whether it was more helpful or confusing.
I'm not saying, but I would want them either parallel with a sentence in each of the commentary explaining it. Either way you go to do it, otherwise I think there's silly arguments, but I don't want to be wasting time in court arguing that because it's a house of worship, it's not an ad.
Sure.
It only comes in lower. Yeah. That kind of silly.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
And we already talked about graffiti, so.
Look at that. Excellent. All right. 456, any last comments?
I still didn't understand the problem you had with the gradations in unauthorized UUV.
All right, what I think...
You don't want to decriminalize. You're saying you don't want to decriminalize the passenger, or you just don't want any gradations at all.
I want a passenger to be treated like a driver because that's how it's currently treated.
I see.
And just like if we're going to be translating on these other things and say what we're doing is carrying over what we have, I don't understand why we're making a distinction.
I understand. But based on my experience,
it's a group event and a driver one day, 1 hour, is the passenger the next hour. And that it seems wrong to treat them differently merely because of who's caught at the moment.
Interesting.
That's all I got. If that's all.
Oh.
Thank you, guys. It's helpful.
Thank you, guys.
We had this kind of intense little every 2 weeks thing going on there in Tupelo. So feel free to do that.
Just so you guys know, I shot up some case law to Rich this morning on the merger stuff and the Court of Appeals and all of that.
We talked last meeting about, again, finding another way to handle kind of the ultimately wanting to kind of ensure merger and not having the collateral consequences of excess.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't opposed to the concept.
But
I just thought there was a
procedural
cleaner,
way,
procedural way based on current law to handle it, and I shot Richard the case law.
Yep.
For whatever it is.
Yep. So, and we'll take a look into that more. And good. All right. Thanks.